And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. And we're on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, September 4th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Greg Hurwitz. Greg is the critically acclaimed New York Times and internationally best-selling author of 12 novels, most recently They're Watching, You're Next, The Survivor, and Tell No Lies. His books have been nominated for numerous awards, shortlisted twice for the Best Novel of the Year by International Thriller Writers, nominated for CWA's Ian Fleming Steel Dagger, chosen as feature selections for all four major literary book clubs, honored as BookSense Picks, nominated for the Galaxy National Book Award, and translated into 22 languages. He's written screenplays for or sold spec scripts to many of the major studios and written, developed, and produced television, including ABC's V, for various networks. He's also a New York Times best-selling comic book writer, having penned stories for Marvel and DC. He's published numerous academic articles on Shakespeare, taught fiction writing at USC's English department, and guest lectured for UCLA and for Harvard in the United States and internationally. He grew up in the Bay Area while completing a BA from Harvard and a master's from Trinity College, Oxford. In Shakespearean tragedy, he wrote his first novel. He was the undergraduate scholar athlete of the year for Harvard for his pole vaulting exploits and played college soccer in England, where he was a Knox Fellow. He now lives in L.A., where he continues to play soccer, frequently injuring himself. And he's here primarily today to talk about Tell No Lies, although we'll be talking about so much more. Hey, Greg.
How are you?
Great. Great to have you here with me. We'll have you on the phone with me today. You know, your bio, I mean, you know, where do you fit it in? I mean, you've written spec scripts, you've written novels, you've written comic books. You know, how do you do all this?
Well, sleep is usually the thing to go. But I mean, one of the things that I found is that one of the advantages to working on so many different projects is that the other ones are sort of simmering on the side burners. So when it comes time to actually sit down and write, there's not a lot of, like, gape jawed staring at the blank screen. You know, by the time it's finally time to turn my focus to a comic script that's due or the next chapter in a novel, I've thought about it because I've been sort of working in another thing that's tangentially related but not that thing. And so I can be pretty efficient with my time. I've pretty good, and I also, you know, I work a lot. I mean, that's also the not-so-secret secret. You know, I mean, I'm up at a minimum every day. I'm working from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m., and those are my short days, and I'm writing the bulk of those.
Has it always been that way? Were you like that from the beginning?
You know, I was. Well, I should say I started that first book really, really young. I was 19 years old, and I kind of wrote when I was inspired, which was over the summers. I was trying to finish up school, so I was doing it sort of when inspired, and then I got really, really lucky, and I sold that first book when I was younger than I reasonably should have. And I remember saying to myself, this is all you've ever wanted, is to be a novelist, mm-hmm. You know, from birth. And now I had sold a book to Simon & Schuster, and I had enough money to support myself at my exceedingly lean lifestyle for a couple of years. You know, I bought a car that could run the 300,000 miles. I bought a Honda because they can go forever. And I basically kept exactly my same lifestyle. And I thought, now, since this is what you've always wanted, now you got to do this. And I started working 9 to 5.
Well, it's interesting that you were going for a master's in Shakespearean tragedy when you wrote your first novel.
I'm sorry, what's the question?
I said it was interesting that you were going for a master's in Shakespearean tragedy.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, look, the tragedies are so much like thrillers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a funny question that mm-hmm. I get asked a lot, and it's like, why would someone who studies Shakespearean tragedy write thrillers? And it's like, that's what they are.
Yeah, you know, no, it makes total sense.
Yeah, they're convention-bound, plot-driven narratives about lust, intrigue, and murder. I mean, that, you know, they were designed to put butts in chairs and sell out the Globe Theater. It was fun vacillating. I had started my first book before that, But during my time there, I was really revising it. I wrote my thesis I had to write a piece of a dissertation for the master's in sort of one manic fueled burst to get it out of the way. And then I was mostly sort of playing soccer over there and trying to finish and edit this novel. And you know, like I said, I mean, I sold it earlier than I reasonably could have expected to.
Well, it's also interesting, you know, Shakespearean tragedy and the dramatic sort of movement of a piece. And I would imagine that it taught you a lot about plotting, because your books are, they seem so, the plots seem to be subtle, and yet looking back, there you can see from the start the seeds that you've planted.
Well, you know, you're right in that, you know, with Shakespeare, I mean, one of the things with the plays is they're so impeccably structured, obviously. They're confined to a set structure. And, you know, there's a lot of things that I learned. You know, people say, well, how do you learn to be a writer? Do you take classes? Did you read books? I didn't do any of that. I just love novels. You know, so it's like if you read 1,000 novels, you'll have a pretty good idea of how they function. And, you know, there's a similar thing with the tragedies. I didn't study them with any knowledge of why I was drawn to Shakespearean tragedy. It's like a lot of times you can only see the connections looking back, not forward. When you're making choices, I think the best thing to do is just pursue things that are of interest to you, and you'll figure out why you pursued them later. But what you're saying, I think, is exactly right, in that, you know, really digging into the structure of Shakespearean tragedy, that teaches you pacing. Mm-hmm. That teaches you structure. That teaches you how a commercial piece, which is what all of his plays were, are supposed to function. And so that was a very big part of it. And, you know, now I'm, I don't know, 13 books in, and there's a very, you know, there's some things that you start to get a second sense of that I didn't have when I first started. I first started, you know, I had to do 16 drafts of my first book, you know, in order to get it into shape. And so slowly some of those things go from mental exercises into the gut, and the gut's the best place to write from.
Mm. So 16 drafts for the first novel, and what about now? Tell No Lies, how many drafts did that have to go through? Or you just know how to do it now, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you can always get into trouble. You know, I mean, people will often say, you know, it sounds a little cutesy, but they'll say, oh, every novel's like a kid. You can't pick which one is your favorite. But, I mean, there's also the truth that you don't know what problems they're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
I will say my first draft now is closer to what my sixth draft was when I was starting.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I'd say I probably now do 3 or 4 sort of major passes, and then, you know, a couple polish passes too. But you know, they're, by major, it's nothing like it used to be. I mean, my first book, I wrote a terrible first draft. Somehow I got lawyers and agents out of it. But then when it was time to rewrite it, I had to take the whole thing apart like an engine block and put
mm-hmm.
it back together.
Mm.
And that was true for my second novel also. I got to a point that it wasn't working, and I had to back up. You know, I remember, like, the image I have in my head is literally sitting in the living room with the pieces spread out all around me and just figuring out what research fills the blank, how does it go back together, which you know, widget goes where. And, you know, by my third book, I knew how to write a book. My rough draft was a functional rough draft, you know, to then be improved upon,
mm-hmm.
rather than let's step back and have a big picture conversation kind of first draft.
Sure. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Greg Hurwitz. His new book is Tell No Lies. So how much do you know starting out? I mean, for Tell No Lies, do you do, say, you know, character Bibles for Daniel, Christina, Evelyn, plot summaries, or do you know where you end, where you were going to end with the novel? I mean, how much did you know going in?
You know, I started writing no outlines at all, and then I outlined increasingly, which hit their peak in my 7th or 8th book, and then I went back to virtually no outline, but pages and pages of notes. I don't do character Bibles, I don't do that kind of stuff, but I've thought about a book, like I already know my next book. I'm already thinking about it. I should just say I have notions.
Mm-hmm.
And so through, you know, that gives me a lot of lead time to pick up this character beat, and to pick up this scene, and to pick up this plot twist, and to kind of keep adding to them in this file, that it will be a large, unwieldy file of, you know, 35 pages of bullet points, which I then shape into rough categories. But I write with sort of two screens, and on one screen is the outline, and on one screen is the novel. And it starts off, and the novel has 0 pages, and the outline has 30 to 70 pages of notes and thoughts. And at the end, you know, the novel page has 400 pages and the outline page has zero because it's all been absorbed into the book. But having them both in electronic format for me guarantees that the script, that the outline, quote-unquote, the page of notes and thoughts is ever-evolving. So as I write something, both documents are always sort of living and breathing and growing all the way through the process. So I'm not writing from a fixed outline, which A, bores me, and B, hems me in to some things that wouldn't leave me as open to discovery. If I get into a scene and one character is really working well. You know, in this case, with Tell No Lies, it was Evelyn. She just wrote herself. Mm-hmm. I usually get one free character per book. Writes themselves. And so then all of a sudden, I wanted her to feature more prominently. And the more I wrote her, the more lines I had for her, and the more I shoved them in the other outline to get to.
So what was the genesis of Tell No Lies? Where'd that story come from?
Well, the first part of the story, you know, for me, it often starts with a conundrum. It's often sort of a moral dilemma or debate. When that meets a character who I feel in my bones, that's when I know I have a novel. And to know you have a novel means you're committing to spend more time in that story than in the real world or with your family for a year. Like, that's no small commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the notion, the sort of Hitchcockian premise, was what if you started getting death threats accidentally that were intended for other people, and you alone were privy to sort of these life or death deadlines? And I thought, what a fascinating situation to put an everyman character into. You start getting the wrong death threats in the mail, and the first one you get too late, as Daniel does. By the time he goes home and opens the mail, he first thinks it's a death threat for himself. He's horrified. His wife is there with him, realizes it's not intended for him, and that the deadline passed 2 days ago. And the threat reads very simply, admit what you've done or you'll bleed for it. And so they do the first thing once they realize that it was, you know, addressed to someone else and the deadline passed 2 days ago. They do what any of us would do, which is they Google the name it was addressed to.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, 2 days prior in the Tenderloin, the man who it was intended for was brutally murdered. Now they know it's real. And so he increasingly finds himself wound into this case, into the series of revenge killings, and he has this unique perspective, and it keeps circling closer and closer to home. And that sort of premise for a story for me was the first thing that came. And I would say Daniel was the second. And then I had them both, and I thought, okay, we're off to the races now.
Yeah. I mean, I think what, you know, I'm about halfway through the book, and I find that, you know, there's a sense of dread in each chapter, and the chapters are fairly short, which I like, because, you know, I tend to look at chapters and see how long they are before I dive in, and if I feel like I don't have enough time to complete it, I might not read that chapter yet, but I just love that sense of dread that just continues. It just goes on, and it's just, again, another kind of, in most of the chapters, it's very subtle.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the aim, so thank you. I mean, that's one of those things that I spend a lot of time working on. How are we going to ratchet up that tension, and how do you take it up one degree at a time? And this is sort of not the big slam opening that many of my books have.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Survivor is a big opening first chapter with a hook. I mean, this is more of that variety of, you know, you got the frog in the pot of water on the stove, and you're just turning it up one degree at a time. I mean, that's what this one is. So that sense of sort of dread and of quickening, for lack of a better word, is very much what my focus was on. So I'm pleased to hear that worked, at least for you.
The first book of yours that I read was The Crime Writer, and that started with a bang. I mean, you know, man, what an interesting premise that was, too. It seems like you have no end of interesting premises that you give your characters, which makes me just want to, of course, read all your books now. But,
well, that's good. That's the aim. thank you.
Like The Crime Writer, how did that, you know, where did that come from?
The Crime Writer I thought about literally for like 4 years, and I just thought, part of it is, The Crime Writer is based in part on how weird my own life is,
mm-hmm.
and the weird people, the weird, exciting, fun, engaged people I have in orbit around me. I mean, I have on my Rolodex, you know, Army Rangers and porn stars and professors and demolition breachers and criminalists. And, I mean, there's all these people I've picked up over the years. And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if I was accused of a crime that in some ways I have a kind of skill set to imagine what I have just enough knowledge to get myself into more trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think I know more than I do because I've researched a lot and I've seen a lot and I know a lot and I have friends who are prosecutors, I have friends who are public defenders. But, like, there's also a lot that I don't know. And I want to write a book about the difference between the reality and the fiction version and also the way that I would go about navigating a crime in which I myself was implicated by using the same resources and skill sets that I've brought to writing at the time, my prior seven novels. And it was important to me not to make Drew Danner, my novelist, precious and a huge success. Like, I made him sort of a more real, you know, writer who's enjoyed some success, but he's not, you know, I didn't want to make it kind of clever and polished.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, you type the end and that's the end of the book, and, you know, so he's a writer of some acclaim, but he's got these contacts, and now, you know, half of them hate him because they think he's guilty of something, and half don't, and so he's trying to kind of wind his way through reconstructing and authoring the story of what happened to him.
Hmm.
The opening being that he, you know, wakes up blurry and fuzzy headed, and he has a, you know, he's in a hospital room, he's got dirt under his nails, he raises his hand to his head and feels a line of stitches on his skull from some head injury, and as his focus comes in, slowly clarifies, he sees the two men in the room are detectives sitting before him, and one shows him a picture of a woman cut stem to stern, and he says, Jesus, what, you know, what happened to her, or who is that? They say, it's your ex-fiance. And he says, who did that to her? And they say, you did. And he realizes as his hand passes back in front of his face that it's not, in fact, dirt beneath his nails, but it's blood.
Mm-hmm.
He has no recollection of what happened. And so it is the story of how you then would author or rewrite the story of the events of the preceding 2 days of which he has no memory.
Hmm. Yeah, after reading, getting to the end of that book, I wanted to, and I still do want to reread it now and study it and see, you know, sort of deconstruct it and see how you got to the end and what happened to him. It's I'm wondering if you plant clues later or as you're going along. Like with Tell No Lies, did you know, as I said, I'm halfway through, so who knows? I don't know exactly who we're looking for, but I'm curious if you're planting clues, you know, that when I get to the end I can look back and go, oh yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. That's part of the process.
But I mean, do you do that after the fact?
That I can use later as a clue.
Uh-huh. So do you do that after the fact, as you go along, or both?
No, I mean, I usually know the whole opening, and then I start looking at what pieces, you know, what pieces I have. It's funny, I just was on talking to a director friend of mine, and it's a metaphor many directors have used, so if I try to source it, it'll go to like 10 different people. But one of the things he talked about when you're shooting a movie, he said it's a lot like you're going to the grocery store to prepare for the meal. You're grabbing all the ingredients, you're getting them all in the cart, and editing is when you cook the meal for a movie. And it's interesting because in a way I feel like this sort of notes process with the premise and the ideas and the scenes, that's like the process of going to the store. And then as you start to cook the meal, you start to realize that you need, you know, more garlic and less this, and you forgot an ingredient, and then you need to add something, and then you go back and feather it through. And so it's evolving. It's not static.
Hmm.
You know, and, you know, it's funny because you'd asked earlier what I need to know to sort of start or when I – how it begins. I have that starting premise, but you've seen those indoor rock climbing places, right? I mean, for me, I always think of, like, I have certain key scenes that are like those hand or footholds across the bare wall. I don't know exactly where they go. I don't know exactly how I'll get there, but I know that there's enough of those key concrete scenes that I will use as handholds to get me from page 1 to page 400. And that, you know, again, I don't know what contortions it'll take, and maybe I thought one was a left foothold and it's actually a right hand hold, but I know that there's enough of those plugs in that wall for me to look at the wall and regard it as a novel.
Interesting. I'd love to hear you read from Tell No Lies. Would you do that?
Yeah, sure. Okay. I will read a section that I consider my dirty love letter to San Francisco.
Okay.
And to set the template, Daniel Brasher, who is my protagonist, is from one of the richest founding families in San Francisco, and he's recently sort of given that up to work as a group therapist. He's stopped managing his family portfolio. He works in a room with violent group offenders, recovering from prison, trying to rehab them. Any spark in the room can explode into violence. And he has now discovered the first few of these letters, these death threats that have accidentally gone to him, and he's just been pulled into the scene of a murder that was horrific beyond belief. He's been injured. He got kicked in the face in the process of a pursuit, and he's now driving home through his beloved San Francisco that he's always seen through the sort of very affluent, privileged lens, and he's seeing the whole city in a different light. The sun broke across the horizon, fanning a sheet of gold through the iconic skyline. Daniel was weary, half asleep behind the wheel, the early morning haze of the city a match for the early morning haze muffling the steady throb in his head. He cut past the Castro, where Latina drag queens in fishnets and feathers paraded the sidewalks, strutting past bars with inventively uninventive names, the Lonely Bull, the Missouri Mule, Dirty Dicks. He kept on skirting the edge of the Hate, where painted VW buses and druggy runaways littered the curbs in search of a lost decade. During the Summer of Love, Janis Joplin strummed her Gibson in a one-room flop pad here, a tambourine throw from where the Grateful Dead commune tuned in and dropped out. Relics of each era endured, strata-layered in storefronts, charting the evolution from beatniks to hippies to yuppies to bohemians. Forging north, Daniel sliced through Alamo Square, its picket row of pastel Victorians basking in the first pink-tinged rays of the new day. Beyond their fanciful gingerbread gables rose the green copper dome of City Hall, where ousted Catholic and local sandlotter made good Joe DiMaggio said I do to Marilyn, and where, a couple of decades later, five hollow point bullets cut down Harvey Milk in the corridors of power. So much glory and shame. So much beauty and horror. A city that burned to the ground six times before its first decade flamed out, yet rose from the ashes again and again. A boxer who wouldn't stay down. He let his imagination soar across the rooftops to the Tenderloin, where dealers in saggy pants palmed baggies into skeletal hands and tranny hookers batted improbable eyelashes and held cigarettes to their smeared lips, smoking off the night's work. Mere blocks to yet another ecosystem, capitalism clean, Union Square on perennial high polish, ornate Christmas displays already gleaming in the vast picture windows, Neiman and Chanel, Saks and the ghost of I. Magnin. Coppola shot the conversation in the conversation here, but even his surveillance camera couldn't capture the dead-end alley where Miles Archer met his fictional demise, or the Palace Hotel, where President Harding was felled by an enlarged heart, or a poisonous wife. A Peter Pan drift took Daniel to Russian Hill with its manic slalom descents, its vertiginous tumble over the brink of Filbert, its manicured floral gardens cupping the curves of Lombard, the second crookedest street in the city. Steve McQueen's Mustang scorched these slopes in the world's greatest car chase, the fleeing Charger losing an unlikely six hubcaps in the process. Then on to North Beach in all its gaudy Italian glory. There perched City Lights bookstore where Ginsberg howled, the wedged facade gazing nobly across the intersection at the world's first topless bar, if the historical plaque is to be believed. Carol Doda bared her Double D Twin Peaks here at the Condor Club, a skip from Green Street where Philo T. Farnsworth lived up to his madcap inventor's name and conjured into existence the world's first TV. And overseeing all this squalid, soaring history, the fluted column of Coit Tower, the candle stuck in the cupcake of Telegraph Hill. All those tales of the city, all those separate lives, misfits and dreamers, transplants and immigrants, victims and outlaws, packed full of hidden fears and sordid impulses, inflated fantasies and rageful desires. They'd come heeding the siren's call, seeking haven, to the sanctuary city thrust into a swirl of ever-shifting tides and mist. A peninsula draped over seven hills, twinkling and glorious with jutting heights and precipitous drops, a labyrinthine, fog-veiled confusion of one-ways and narrow alleys, shadow and light, a microcosm of the human psyche in all its splendor and horror, its seething, brilliant, hideous capabilities. So many places to hide, so many ways to disappear, all those masks, imagined and real, and beneath one of them, a killer.
Thank you so much. That was Greg Hurwitz reading from Tell No Lies, published by St. Martin's Press. I'm so glad you read that section, because I lived in San Francisco and haven't been back for a few years. And I just was so happy to be in the setting, actually, and all the details that you pulled out and the conversation, you know, filmed at Union Square and just different things that you have in there. And I wonder if you would talk about setting a bit, how important setting is to Tell No Lies and maybe your books in general.
Well, it's funny because people talk about places, character so much, and I've thought about that a lot. And it's like, what does that mean? And I think what it means is when you have a book that can take place nowhere else, that's when a place becomes a character in a book. And I'm from San Francisco. I was born there. I'm one of the few San Franciscans who prefers Southern California, though I've adopted everything about L.A., except I kept the Giants, which was a great decision up until about 3 months ago. But I'm from the city, and as I thought of this story, as I thought about Daniel, who's from this really privileged background and Tell No Lies and decides to work, you know, south of Market, you know, for as a metaphor, but also literally, in this group of violent offenders, there's a way that class and race function differently in San Francisco than anywhere else. And the more that I thought about this story, and the more that I thought about the death threats that he was getting, the fact that he, you know, in the book he marries sort of a broke Mexican girl from the Mission who's a community organizer. There's an interplay of the way that society needs to function, that class and race need to function, that would only work in San Francisco. And I realized that 13 books in, that this would be the first book that would actually take me home. And that was, you know, and so home I went.
Interesting. Yeah, that, you know, that's really interesting. So you have, I mean, one thing that's happening in Tell No Lies is you have the plot, the murder, but you have all this sort of these subplots going on that are really kind of interesting and that, like you said, have to do with class and have to do with so much else. And is that something that you're working on before you start writing to see, you know, okay, what's going to be the main, you know, deal with this book and what's going to be underlying it?
Well, I think I think I started having notions and I thought, you know, what if you're getting death threats? Of course, then I had Daniel. What if he is the, you know, the sole survivor of this enormous family fortune? You know, the Brashers, one of the founding families of San Francisco, and his mom is a horrific, like, devouring mother archetype in a way. I mean, she's brutal, but she's got that great offset, just dry, devastating wit. And so, you know, the fact that he married a broke Mexican girl from the Mission, I mean, there's one point where Evelyn, his mom, has a line that for me was very emblematic of her, where at some point she's accused of being racist because she doesn't like his Mexican wife. And she says, oh, no, dear, right. I'm not racist. If she had money, do you think I would care? I'm classic.
Right.
Very different.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, how race and class came into it grew out of, you know, first Daniel as a guy who's this rich white guy who lives in Pacific Heights, which is nicknamed Pacific Whites, you know, who's working across town and south of Market in this horrible metro building with violent offenders who are for the most part minorities. And so the book started to become very much about that. These murder threats started to be tied up in wealth and privilege, and these themes kind of were emerging. And then once that happens, I don't write from a theme backwards. I'm a nuts and bolts story guy. But once it starts to develop that's what the story is about and deals with, then, of course, I'll look for more and more opportunities to have that enter the discussion.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm thinking back again to your background in Shakespearean tragedy and thinking, you know, about MFA programs and how, in some ways, going for a master's in something like Shakespearean tragedy might serve you better as a writer.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the other thing we learned from Shakespearean tragedy is that the fault doesn't lie in the stars. The fault always lies in the heart of the protagonist. Like, the downfall has to be through some moral misstep, no matter how small, that is committed by your main character, or else all you're doing is reading about when bad things happen to good people, and that's not drama, that's life, you know. We get enough of that in our own lives, and so that's one of the things that Shakespeare really taught me, is like the basis of tragedy, the basis of drama itself has to be that the characters whatever the consequences are, they don't deserve it. Lear doesn't deserve what happens to him. But the character's moral misstep is what opens the door to unforeseen consequences, no matter whether they're commensurate or not.
Hmm. So then you have to know that when you start. So you had to know what Daniel's moral misstep was right at the beginning, before you begin.
Yes.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's a key part of, you know, the character with all his flaws and glory. And, you know, in this case, it's an exceedingly subtle misstep.
Hmm. Yeah, now I have to think about that. But anyway, I was curious about details, because there are a lot of details from the current era, the present, in which the book takes place, smart cars, Audis, and I know some writers don't like to include specific details because they fear dating their work. And obviously this isn't a worry of yours, and I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, for me, there's certain things that will date a work well, and there's some that don't. And so one of the things, you know, we were just having this conversation for a script that I was working on. I think jokes about celebrities date very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want a Kato Caitlin joke in your book. You know, it's like
right.
There's some things that don't continue to play. And there's other things that are, look, if you write a period piece, if you look at books that are set in the past, they make use of all of the, to bring a story to life of what that setting is at the time, you know. So I don't understand why we'd remove that and write in sort of generic non-name brand terms in the present. You know, if I was writing mm-hmm. a book that took place in my childhood, someone would walk into a kitchen and it would have an avocado green counter and the horrible mustard yellow ovens and the, you know,
mm-hmm.
like all the toys, all the things that would be reminiscent of that time would be what I would be writing about. You know, people would be driving a Dasher, you know. and so I don't know why you would remove and leech a contemporary book of any setting. But again, it's like, do I want to make a bunch of Miley Cyrus jokes about how, you know, the MTV Teen Awards went last week? Probably not. I mean, there's things that there's things that are iconic of an age, and then there's things that are of the moment, that are fleeting, that are sort of a flash in the pan interest, you know. So you don't want to be incorporating things that have the brain width of a tweet in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a great point, actually. We have just a couple of minutes left with Greg Hurwitz. His book is Tell No Lies, published by St. Martin's Press. Curious. And winding down here, if you hit times where you are in a place, you need to write yourself out of a place that's not working. And I'm curious what you do if you hit those moments, and if you go on to another project, or you wait it out, or you just barrel through. What happens?
Well, I don't have those classic moments of writer's block where I sit there and think, you know, gosh, I can't come up with anything, and I'm staring at the page. I do have times when I'm breaking a story, quote-unquote, that I'll be staring and just really thinking. Like, that can be a lot of the day, especially in early stages of a novel. Like, there's times where I'm trying to think about how I'm going to arrange the pieces most elegantly. But, I mean, one of the things that happens, I've been writing now, I started, gosh, at 19, and for the most part, I've been writing 8 to 10 hours a day. And so part of what happens is like any, I compare it a lot to being, people talk about my academic background a lot, as we have here, but one of the things that was really helpful for me was my athletic background. And if you think about what distinguishes a professional athlete versus an amateur, is that on their worst day, a professional athlete is still producing at a certain level. And so when I was writing my first two books, when I was inspired and writing well, I didn't need any help any more than a baseball player in AAA needs help when he's having the best game of his life. But the difference is, if you're Miguel Cabrera, is on your worst day, you're still putting in good at-bats, you're still performing in the field. And I think it's like, that's the one thing I've sort of earned through the process of writing for 20 years now, is like, on my worst day, I can make headway still. It's
mm-hmm.
not the best headway, it's not the most inspired, it might need to be rewritten more heavily, you know, it might not be the most productive and the highest page word count, but I don't have days that I go into my office and sit there and don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've always been, and part of that is also, like, I've always been an advocate of just get something down on paper. If you can't get it down, you can't make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And so with younger writers, I always advocate just get out a vomit draft. Who cares how awful it is? Get everything out on the page, and then you'll look at it and go, wow, that's awful. Let me cut this part. Let me cut this part. And that happens all the way through. I mean, there's stuff I go back and read and just cringe. I mean, but if it's not there for me to read, I'm not going to know. And if it's stuck in my head, then no headway is going to be made.
Well, you go where the heat is. In other words, if you're, you know, you have, you know, you write comic books, you write screenplays. Will you, you know, put a novel aside and go to a screenplay, or likewise put down a screenplay and go to the novel you're working on? Or are you a one project, you know, to the end writer?
It used to be one project to the end writer. The demands of the four jobs, comics, TV, novels, and scripts, and features, it's gotten different. And so what I do now is I blast through whatever portion. It used to be, I'm writing my rough draft, everyone leave me alone for X months. But now, if something comes up where someone says, look, I have a great screenwriting job, can you take it for, you know, X weeks? There's things that are too fun to say no to. I have a very hard time saying no to things that are fun. Mm-hmm. So it made me a very difficult child to parent in high school. but, you know, so what I'll try to do is get a book to a resting place. You know, I'll get through a chunk that is sort of logically blocked off. Let me get through this opening chunk. Let me get through the first act. And then I'll go work on something else. For the most part, with comic scripts, screenplays, and, you know, TV, and that includes treatments and all those different stages, and even writing them, I can always blast through a rough draft fairly uninterrupted. I mean, maybe I'm interrupted to, you know, peruse some art or look at some lettering from a comic or something like that. But for the most part, I can get through that. But with the novels, I try and get them to a resting place, at least now. But I'm a little more scattered than I used to be, which is a high-class problem to have to manage. So I won't complain about it.
Mm. And you have gone so many places to research your novels. You've swum with the sharks. You've gone undercover into mind-control cults. When you're starting out, you may not be able to take time off to do these sorts of things, and yet perhaps you want something more in your novel. I mean, what did you do at the beginning? Did you just find a way to go wherever you needed to go to get your early books done?
I mean, I had sold one book when I spent, you know, a sizable percentage of the money in my bank account to go to Galapagos to research the second one. Because I figured if I'm not going to bet on myself, given the odds of success as a writer, like, why would anyone else? So I never had safety nets. I never had backup plans. And I went to Galapagos, and I lied and said that I was a scientist so I could get into the Darwin Research Station, a particular thing in the ecology I needed to research for my thriller. And, you know, I couldn't get – now it's much easier, so I don't want to downplay that. But I was willing to scrape and talk to, you know, a friend's dad worked here, and his friend was an FBI guy, and can I get him on the phone? I mean, I was just – you know, right now writers have so many more resources. I mean, we didn't have the internet when I was starting. You can look up so much stuff, but there is no replacement for getting on scene, of watching an autopsy, of watching a body get carved up. There's no replacement for that. And, you know, talking to the people, having drinks with guys who are snipers, and hearing the lilt of the cadence of their language. I mean, there's firsthand stuff, and I always feel like my job is to bring the reader to a front row seat of the action. And I want to know, it's why, you know, I was born in San Fran, I've spent a ton of time there. Before I wrote this book, I went back extensively and spent a lot of time in the city. And as someone once said, if you get tired walking around the city, you can always lean against it. And I hiked and walked and drove and leaned because I want the reader to feel like they have a front row seat to something. And that's me getting back and engaging all my senses so that that can be conveyed in the most thrilling way possible to the reader. And you never know which telling detail is gonna pop out and, you know, lift the hairs at the back of their neck.
Hmm. And in closing, I'm curious if you read your work aloud, because as you read that section, there was a certain rhythm to your words, to your sentences, that I got more from hearing you. And now, of course, I'm going to put your voice to the words on the page. But at any point, do you read your work aloud to hear how it sounds, to hear where the beats are? And
Sometimes, like a sentence. I mean, I don't read everything out loud that way, but now and then I'll be on a plane writing, and I'll start, like, there will be a line of dialogue I'm working through, and I'll start talking to myself. But it's not in any sort of formal way. Like what I just read, mm-hmm. I've only read once it's time, you know, for to go out and have a book tour and I'm picking a passage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's very rare. I don't sit and read the book out loud, but I hear it that way in my head. So, you know, I've been doing it long enough that's what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. So. Sure.
But, you know, dialogue, it helps to do that sometimes.
Mm.
Or sometimes if you have a gummed up sentence that just isn't working, I'll say it out loud a couple times
mm-hmm.
to just see, is this making sense? Is it simple enough?
Yes. And any last words or advice for the writers listening?
Well, there is no substitute for, you know, button chair time. Like, nothing will beat that. And you can go to 1,000 writers' conferences. You can take 1,000 writers' classes, which will teach structure because it's the one thing that can be taught. It's very hard to teach dialogue because it's different every time, or character. And there is no, you know, and I think increasingly in this age of access with Internet and Facebook, and people can be in touch with everyone, and everyone's, we're a bit more of a shortcut society. And I think that one of the things that's absolutely essential is to learn writing from writing. There's no other way to do it. So if you've been to X conferences and read X books, it's like put all that away and sit down and start writing and start making mistakes. There's no way to learn about how to write aside from doing it and messing it up. That's mm-hmm. the only way that you can learn. And the other thing that I would say is that you got to keep at it and keep at it. And instead of writing like 16 drafts of one novel, you want to keep 16 drafts of 16 new stories. You do 16 drafts of one book. You need to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And if you give up at the point that your book is 90% there, it won't get bought, or 98% there. You need to provide the best possible version of your story. And, you know, the last thing that I'll say in parting is, you know, it's, when I was a kid, I was a big fan of Peter Benchley, who wrote Jaws, and I wrote him a letter, and I was in fifth grade. He sent me back a letter that was so discouraging. He said, "It's a tough life, but I suppose if you have to do it, you will." And I thought, who writes that to like a 12-year-old, you know? But the more I think about it, the more it was really brilliant, because it's like if you can be happier selling commercial real estate or being an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor or a nurse or a plumber, if you can be equally happy, then you probably should.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I found with writers is the people who are successful, it tends to be because they have a compulsion. It's a compulsion to write. And, you know, one thing that I say, especially living in Los Angeles, I meet a ton of people who want to be writers, and I meet very few people who want to write. And so if you are a writer, you want to write, and you're probably writing already, and make sure you keep doing it, and good luck.
That's great. And you've been great, and I have so appreciated you taking the time, and I'll let you go because I know you're busy, but I'll tell all the listeners out there where you're going to be down here in Orange County this week, and thank you so very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome.
Take care.
That was Greg Hurwitz. His new book is Tell No Lies, and as I said, I'm about halfway through, and I'm loving it, and I'm going to stay with it. And the first book, also, if you've been here since the start of the show, his first book that I read was The Crime Writer, and I probably picked it up and was attracted to it because of the title. I just, you know, I love books about writers, and I will check them out. I may not read them, but I'll at least check them out, and his first chapter grabbed me and wouldn't let me go, and there's a bunch of stuff about writing in it, too, and I love that one, so I guess I'm a fan, huh? I guess I've become a fan. He is going to be at Mystery Inc. Bookstore on Saturday down here in Huntington Beach. If you're in Orange County, he's all over the place, and you can go to his website, greghurwitz.com. It's Greg with two G's, G-R-E-G-G, Hurwitz.com, and see where he's going to be. But Saturday, September 7th, 11 a.m., at Mystery Inc., Debbie Mitch's bookstore. If you've been to the Pen on Fire speaker series, Debbie is occasionally there selling books. Her store is at 8907 Warner, number 135 in Huntington Beach. 11 a.m. Saturday. I'm going to try to go to that because I've never met Greg in person, and I'd like to and have my book signed. We have a Pen on Fire salon coming up next Tuesday night here in Corona Del Mar, not far from UCI, 7 o'clock. Ron Carlson, who's a fiction writer, he's been on the show, has a new novel, and he also runs the MFA program here at UCA. What's UCA? That must be something, but at UCI. And he will be there talking about his new book, talking about writing, and so much more. And you can find out by going to penonfire.com. Click on Speaker Series along the menu at the top, and it'll take you to the page that talks about next Tuesday night's event. Other than that, I think we're at the end of our time. We'll be back next week. I think Nicole is here next week. If I'm not mistaken, I should have my schedule here. But in any case, the show will be here next Wednesday at 9. Thank you so much for spending your morning here. And now it's time to write. So you could continue listening to the reggae show coming up. That would be fun to listen to and write to and even warm up to. However you do it, you've got to get some writing in today. Have a great week. See you next time.